Right. Kachid. Someone.
Someone.
Aho. Says. Ajam. The unborn. Jatam.
Being born.
Punya Shlokasya.
Of the great pious king.
Kirtaye.
For glorifying.
Yadaho of King Yadu. Priyasha
of the deer.
Anvavaye in the family of Malayasha. Malaya Hills. Eva
as
Chandanam Sandalwood. Translation. Some say that the unborn is born for the glorification of pious kings. And others say that he is born to please King Jadu, one of your dearest devotees. You appear in his family as sandalwood appears in the Malaya Hills. So purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Because the Lord's appearance in this material world is bewildering, there are different opinions about the birth of the unborn. In the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says that he takes his birth in the material world, although he is the Lord of all creation and he is unborn. So there cannot be any denial of the birth of the unborn, because he himself establishes the truth. But still, there are different opinions as to why he takes his birth. That is also declared in the Bhagavad Gita. He appears by his own internal potency to reestablish the principles of religion and protect the pious and to annihilate the impious. That is the mission of the appearance of the unborn. Still, it is said that the Lord is there to glorify the pious King Yudhisthira. Lord Sri Krishna certainly wanted to establish the kingdom of the Pandavas for the good of all in the world. When there is a pious king ruling over the world, the people are happy. When the ruler is impious, the people are unhappy. In the age of Kali, in most cases, the rulers are impious, and therefore the citizens are also continuously unhappy. But in the case of democracy, the impious citizens themselves elect their representative to rule over them, and therefore they cannot blame anyone for their unhappiness. Maharaj Nal was also celebrated as a great pious king, but he had no connection with Lord Krishna. Therefore, Maharaj Yudhisthira is meant here to be glorified by Lord Krishna. The Lord had already glorified King Yadu, having taken birth in his family. Although he is known as Yadava, Yaduvira, Yadunandana, etc., he is always independent of such obligation. He is just like sandalwood that grows in the Malaya Hills. Trees can grow anywhere and everywhere, yet because the sandalwood trees grow mostly in the area of the Malaya Hills, the name sandalwood and the Malaya Hills are interrelated. Therefore, the conclusion is that the Lord is ever unborn like the sun, and yet he appears as the sun rises on the eastern horizon. As the sun is never the sun of the eastern horizon, so the Lord is no one's son, but he is the father of everything that be. So, Kachid Ahurajam Jatam Punyasloka Yaro Priyasyan Vavahe Malayasyeva Chandanham. So Omagada Tivadanda Shah Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur and Miritam Yena Tasmai Shi Purve Namaha. So, as we were speaking yesterday, when we're talking about the Lord's appearance or the Lord's activities, there's two things. There's the how and the why. You understand? So here, the question is, or the statement by Queen Kunti is dealing with the why rather than the how. In other words, why Krishna comes down. How Krishna comes down is very easily explained. He comes down by his internal potency, avyatma bhutanam ishvaro shupisham, prakritim swam adhisthaya sambhavami atmamaya. He comes down in his original transcendental form, and he comes down by his sweet will, because Krishna... The interesting thing about Krishna, God, for those of you who don't know who Krishna is that he is Aptakama. Optikama means that whatever he desires happens immediately. He can fulfill his own desires. He's Swarat. That's two descriptions of God. Optikama, Swarat. Swarat means what? Does anyone know? Independent. Are any of you independent? Absolutely.
No.
No. Impossible. Because who and what are you dependent on? Not just Krishna. The demigods, you know, the power company, isn't it? I mean, just like we were just in Suva, and one of the towers was knocked down by the hurricane or by the winds, and then the power went off. And so we were very dependent on the power company to have power. In fact, you know, we called Parashuram, where's the power? And he said, there's nothing I can do about it. So even he was not independent. Sometimes we think he's independent. So we're dependent upon so many other living entities. I mean, like Keshav, who are you dependent on, Keshav?
My dad.
Your parents, right? What if your parents don't feed you? What do you do? You get a job?
He'll starve.
He'll starve to death. So you're dependent on your parents, right? Your mother, your father, and also your grandparents, right? And your sister, too. You're dependent on your sister? Really? That's good. So all of us have this like chain of interdependence on other living entities. I mean, even for the functioning of the body, we're dependent upon a Vayu who controls the life airs, or actually the Maruts, who are the different wind gods. Anyone's heard of the Maruts before? Right? Hanuman is known as what? Maruti. That he is the son of one of the Maruts, and one of the Maruts is Vayu. So you have these Maruts. Does anyone know how many Maruts there are? 49, yes. 7 times 7. Indra actually split them up. There's a whole story in the Bhagavatam. How Indra was within... When into the womb of Diti and cut up her child into 7 times 7 children. And that's the Maruts, Hare Krishna. So we're dependent on the Maruts just to digest food, evacuate, even open the eyes. Any of the bodily functions are dependent upon the life airs, the different life airs. So there's so much dependence we have. Nobody is actually independent. And of course, ultimately, we're dependent upon Krishna. That we have to realize. Otherwise, if we think we're dependent upon the demigods alone, then we're actually yastu narayanam devam brahma rudradi daivata samat vena viksheta sapashandi bhavetruvam. We're pashandis. You know what a pashandi is? Atheist. Yeah, the Vedic literature say if one thinks that the demigods are equal to Narayan, Samit Vaineva Viksheta, then he's considered a Pashandi or an atheist. So ultimately it's Krishna. However, we do have different obligations to our family members, to demigods and everything like that, but ultimately it's taken care of by worshipping Krishna. So as Nanda Maharaj found out, when he worshipped Krishna instead of Indra, and Krishna protected the residents of Vrindavan from Indra's wrath. However, the point I'm making is we are not independent. Don't think you're independent. You're always dependent. Whereas Krishna is absolutely independent. Whenever he wants something, it happens immediately. Parasya shaktir vividaiva shuyate svabhavaki gyana balakriya cha. What does that mean? That Krishna has multifarious energies, and they're all his first-class servants. Just like a first-class servant who does the master's bidding without the master asking. A second-class servant has to be asked. A third-class servant does it with a great resentment. And a tenth-class servant doesn't do it. Right? So, and most of us don't have first-class servants. Most of us don't even have second-class servants. Most of us have third-class servants, anyway. But that's life. But Krishna has first-class servants and all of his energy. So Krishna just wants something, and it happens. Right? Doesn't even have to go to work, make money, pay his servants, or anything like that. or do any worship of the demigods or worship of anyone else. It happens. That's Swarat, independence, or Aptakama. It's really nice. Of course, we would like to be like that too, wouldn't you? Did you want something? If you just want, what's your favorite food? What is your favorite food? Icha? Pizza?
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. It's interesting. People from all over the world, their favorite food is pizza. No matter what culture they come from. So that if you want it and just appeared before you, or what's your favorite toy, Keshav?
Transformer,
so whatever that is, I don't know what it is. But if you just want it and it just appears before you, wouldn't that be wonderful? There was even a whole book written about that and a movie made about that. It was called The Secret, right? You've ever heard of that before? No one's heard about it. They were making propaganda that if you just want something enough, it happens and you get it. And they showed people meditating on what they wanted, their material desires, and somehow or other the material desires were fulfilled. One person wanted a sports car, and he wanted it so much that he was dreaming of shifting. You understand shifting the car? And then he woke up one morning and a sports car was there. Another young child wanted a bicycle, and he was dreaming so much of the bicycle, he woke up one morning and the bicycle was there. So, unfortunately, it doesn't happen like that. I wish it would happen like that. You know, make life a lot easier, right? You just dream, you have the Shimantaka jewel, and then it's there. And the Shimantaka jewel produces how much gold a day, you know? Kilos and kilos of gold. So that's false propaganda. And that book was very popular, the movie was very popular, because people want to be like God. They want to have this independence, the ability to get whatever they want, when they want it. And in the modern society, there's that propaganda that with the advancement of science, you're going to be able to do that, right? Has anyone heard that propaganda from the scientists? As science advances, now you can pick up your mobile phone and talk to anyone anywhere in the world. And soon you're going to be able to, like Star Trek. You're going to be able to beam to India anytime you want. You know, beam me up. Beam me up. Not Scotty, you know. Beam me up, Shimashunder, you know. I remember when I was young, I went to this thing called the World's Fair. And they were showing how we would have a bright tomorrow. You know, very nice tomorrow. There's always this promise of future happiness. However, you find the more technology, the more material things people have, the more miserable they get. And the more people are able to engage in loving exchanges with Krishna, the happier they get. Just like I was speaking to a family yesterday, and some devotees were saying that our family really criticizes us, and they tell us, you joined this Hare Krishna movement, and you became very unhappy. And I said, but how have you become unhappy? What is their standard for happiness? Their standard for happiness is, you know, how many cars you have in your garage and how much money you have in your bank and how big your house is. But our standard is coming from the heart, how happy someone is, whether someone is smiling. Just like Prabhupada said, we turn hippies into happies. You ever hear that statement before? In other words, by taking up Krishna consciousness, even if you give up some material amenities, you actually become happy by serving Krishna lovingly. And I experienced that in my own life. As I was explaining yesterday to the devotees, I had so much material opulence before I joined in the movement. My family had, we had our own airplane. Imagine having your own airplane and your own sports, I had a sports car. Isn't that every boy wants his own sports car. Just like I was with some of our devotees in New Zealand. And they were asking for blessings. I said, may you have many sports cars. Because it was a young man. And he was showing off. He took me for a ride. And he was gunning the engine. Do you understand? You know, he was showing from how he can go so fast from 0 to 100 in 3 seconds or less. And so he just pinned me to the seat with 3 G's of force as he was doing that. And so he asked for blessings, and I said, may you have many sports cars. And there was another young man who was also from Fiji. These devotees are all from Fiji. And he was showing me all his computers and house. He has like 20 computers. There's three devotees and 20 computers for three devotees. So, no, the iPad, iPod, iMe, iU, you know, whatever. And I was saying, may you have many computers in the future. Millions of computers. So people want those blessings. So there's a misconception. The point is there's a misconception that you can get what you want in this world without Krishna's approval. So we don't accept that. But let's talk about Krishna. As far as how Krishna appears, he appears by his will. That's all. You don't really need to describe more than that. And he comes in his transcendental body. He's unborn, etc. These are all how answers. But as far as why, that's what's being dealt with in this verse. You know, why does Krishna come? Of course, we have the standard answer that Prabhupada quotes in the from the Bhagavad Gita, Parichanaya Sadanam, Sadanam, Vinashaya Shadushkritam. Krishna comes. Wow. Wow. A real sadhu, sadini. So, you have the standard answer that Krishna gives in the Gita, that Krishna comes to annihilate the miscreants, establish religious principles, and protect the devotees. There's that answer, and there's an answer given here that he comes for the glorification of his devotees. And there's other answers, such as he comes because he wants to enjoy fighting, and he can't do that in the spiritual world, right? And there's other answers, such as he comes to show us what it's like in the spiritual world, because if we didn't perceive his pastimes that occur in this material world, we would be left to our own imagination. In other words, we would be left to our sort of anthropomorphic conceptions. What does anthropomorphic mean? Does anyone know? No, anthropomorphic means basically that we have a certain conception of what God would be. Let's take away Shastra, for example. Take away Shastra, you don't know anything about Krishna. So if you had to think about what God would be like, you would project your own particular experiences and understanding upon the Absolute. In other words, as one Greek philosopher said, you know, if Africans had God, he would be black. If horses had God, then God would look like a horse. And that's called anthropomorphic. That's a big word you can throw out to impress people sometimes. Any of you heard of that word before? Yeah. Anthropomorphic means, basically, morphos means like form. Anthros means like human being. So in other words, you project, without Krishna coming down to this world and exhibiting his pastimes, you would have a misunderstanding of who God is. You would speculate, in other words, and you would project your own experiences upon God. You know, I would think that God would look like me, for example. Or not exactly, but because it says in the Bible that we are made in the image of God, right? So therefore, you know, then you have all these different speculations about the nature of God based upon the ascending process, which is, and here's another fancy word, which is not our epistemology. Throw out another fancy word you can use to impress people. Epistemology means, how do you know what you know? It's a branch of philosophy. So our epistemology is descending. You understand? Shabda pramanam. The evidence is coming from Shastra. Whereas most people's method of knowing what they know is ascending. It's based on their own speculation, their own perception, or the speculation or perception of other people. Therefore, in every religion, you have theologians. You know what a theologian means? One who studies theos, or God. And they write books about what they think God is like. For example, there was one gentleman, his name was Harvey Cushman, not Hare Krishna, but Harvey Cushman, and he said, He was trying to speculate on the nature of God because he was seeing bad things happening to good people and good things happening to bad people. So he said, his speculation was, God is actually a very nice person, but things got out of control. In other words, just like you have the sporting games here? You have sporting games in Australia? And usually, either the prime minister or someone throws the first ball of the season. Does that ever happen? I know in America with baseball it's like that. He throws the first ball. But he's not responsible for what happens after that. You know, you can't blame the prime minister if was a New Zealand All Blacks team loses, right? Is that the New Zealand team is called All Blacks? Australia team is called what? Wallabies? So the what a horrible name. Maybe they'll be, I know what a wallaby is, but maybe they'll become wallabies in the next life. Like that, you know, wallabies, all black, you know, what kind of names? I mean, even in America, some of the teams are called alligators, crocodiles, tortoises, you know. It's weird. So in other words, you can't blame the government if a team loses or wins, or praise them or blame them. So in the same way, this person was speculating that God, this is called the prime mover philosophy, if any of you have studied Greek philosophy or before, that this comes from Aristotle, actually, that you can't blame God because he's a good guy, he means well, but things got out of control, you know. It happens like that. Like you know, some of you may have families, and after a while you can't control your children anymore, right? They get to a certain age, and they make their own decisions in life. So you started it, but you're not responsible for how it ends. So they speculate the point. Can you imagine that? You know, God is God, but he's all good, but he's not all-powerful anymore. So they change the definition of God. God is, in our mind, God is, you know, omniscient, which means he sees everything, omnipotent, all-powerful, and all good, omni-beneficial, beneficent. You know, so you got all these omni words. You understand omni words? Omnipotent, omniscient, all these words. That's our definition of God. But they speculate in different ways that God is missing one of those characteristics. Or they speculate that God has no face, or God has no, or God is an old man. Just like in this one chapel called the Sistine Chapel, they have a picture of God being a very old man with arthritis. You know arthritis? You know what arthritis is? And he's just reaching out to someone to give them the breath of life. Or you speculate on the nature of the soul. That the soul, according to many people in different religions, the soul didn't exist before birth. And it will only continue to exist after death if you join their religion. You know, people speculate that. Or the soul will cease to exist, but when the bones come out of the grave, then the soul will come back into existence. That's the standard Christian thing. What do they say? The bone shall rise again? That's why they don't believe in cremation, because there's no bones to come out. Right? Can you imagine the bones coming out of the grave? You know, it'd be frightening. So in other words, there's so much speculation. The point I'm making is there's so much speculation, and the speculation is completely different from what Krishna is presenting, what God himself says. But the nature of most religious beliefs is based on theologians speculating rather than on what God himself says about himself. Therefore, we say, dharmam tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam, that dharma can only be coming down from Bhagavat or Bhagawan or Krishna, God. I mean, you don't have to call God Krishna. You can call him Narayan or Yahweh or Jehovah or what else? Nrsimha or Keshav. You can, just like in this verse, it's quite, in the, not this verse, but in the section of the Bhagavatam that we're reading in the seventh canto where Hiranyakashipu is talking, he's mentioning God. But he uses like a secondary name of God. He uses Isha and other names like that rather than primary names of God that deal with God as a person. So, in any case, we accept what God says as the absolute. So that's a very, very important point as far as our what we call epistemology. Okay? So let's get back to the point of why God comes down. And let's analyze all the different reasons why God comes down. We touched upon a few already. Like he comes down to show us who he actually is. That was the last reason. Or he comes down to annihilate the miscreants. Or he comes down to protect the devotees, establish religious principles. So Prabhupada said elsewhere that Krishna doesn't have to come down to Parichanaya Sadhanam Vinashaya Jadushkritam. Doesn't have to come down to do that. Why? Because though those purposes can be accomplished by his energies. I think Durga is perfectly capable of Parichanaya Sadhanam. Vinashaya Jadushkritam. Annihilating the miscreants. I think the pure devotees are perfectly capable of protecting the devotees or establishing religious principles. So even though Krishna does that, he does that, but that's not really the reason he comes down, because he's not required to do that. In other words, he does it as a secondary reason. So, because in the Lord's advents, there's always a primary reason and a secondary reason. Just like with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there's a primary reason he comes down, and there's a secondary reason. What's the primary reason? To understand the love that Radharani has for him. And what else? There's three aspects. That's one of them. That's a secondary. Because other incarnations or other appearances can do the Sankirtan Yajna. And even in other yugas, the Sankirtan, in other Divya yugas, and other Kali yugas, you have Sankirtan Yajna as the performance, but it's not Chaitanya Mahaprabhu who comes down to teach it. So it's actually a secondary reason that he comes down to teach the Sankirtan movement. However, his primary reasons are, you mentioned one, to understand Radharani's love, to experience her love from her perspective, and to experience the happiness that Radharani experiences. These are the primary. This is from Chaitanya Charitamrita. I'm giving this explanation. These are the three reasons that he comes for his own purposes. Isn't that interesting? That's primary. And secondary, it's not my speculation. This is Chaitanya Charitamrita, translated and purported by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. He comes to establish the Yuga Dharma. It's an important reason. I'm not saying that it's unimportant. However, the primary reasons are his internal reasons. And so let's go to the story of don't forget about Lord Chaitanya, but let's go to the story. Let's talk about Lord Boar fighting Lord Boar fighting Hiranyaksha. So what would be the primary reason for him coming? No.
Experience the fight.
Because who is Hiranyaksha? Yeah, either Jaya or Vijaya. I don't remember which one of the two. And, you know, they're interchangeable. Not really, but, you know, I don't remember which one became who. So the Lord arranged for them to appear as demons. And the same, isn't it? So he could enjoy. It was the Lord's arrangement the demon came down. Or the devotee came down as a demon. Let's say not demon came down, but devotee. So Krishna arranged that because he wanted to enjoy this chivalrous behavior. Just like we have the direct rasas and we have the indirect rasas. So Krishna enjoys that. So he wanted to enjoy. So therefore he had a demon. So not only is it not the principal reason, but also the Lord arranged for the demon to create havoc. Can you imagine that? You know, who's responsible for Hiranyaksha? Krishna is. Who's the one behind it all? Krishna. You know, so Same thing, of course, with Hiranyakashipu, right? Same thing with your friend Robin, right? Same thing with Kumbhakarna. Same thing with Shishupal and Dantavakra. You know, they were really, really nasty creeps. Sorry. But Krishna arranged for them to appear so he could fight them. So there's an internal reason behind all these things. Although it appears, you know, the main reason is Prachanaya Sadam Vinashaya Jadushkritam, but Krishna arranged for the problem in the first place. It's like a government arranging for a problem they can solve. I mean, sometimes they do that. So they can unite the people, they arrange for a war. Did you understand? Let's take a country like North Korea, for example. They arrange for animosity, you know, with all the other civilized, so-called civilized countries. Because we're not really civilized here, you know, it's just... Where we have a veneer of civilization in some of the West. You know what veneer means? Like a thin layer, a coating of civilization, but actually, not all of you, it's not a criticism of any of you, but actually beneath that, you know, civilization, but people are grabbing parts of animals and eating them in a civilized way. Isn't that funny? I mean, instead of like being in the forest and grabbing the leg off of some animal, ripping it off, chewing it. They're doing it in sophisticated restaurants, like that. So let's take North Korea for example. The reason they are focusing so much on, you know, we or, you know, the Western people, whatever, being the bad guys, is because that unites the people. So in other words, they've created us as an enemy. So I'm not seeing Krishna as like North Korea, but. But in other words, he creates his own enemies and fights them. Because he's not going to fight with just any ordinary down to, you know, earth or nonsense demon. Well, Krishna doesn't touch regular demons. Like that Kalyavana. You know the story of Kalyavana? Kalyavana was a regular Yavana. And Krishna didn't want to touch him. So how did Krishna arrange for him to be killed, the children? Do you know that? Never heard. I'll tell you the story. Once upon a time, there was this king, and he fought for the demigods, very powerful king. His name was Muchukunda. And he fought for so many years that he wanted to take a nap. Isn't it when you work hard, you want to take a little nap sometimes? So he fought for so many years for the demigods, and the demigods told him, ask for any benediction, and he said, I just want to take a nap and make sure that nobody wakes me up. Do you ever experience when someone wakes you up, you get angry? Keshav?
Yeah.
So he not only arranged that he could get angry, he arranged that anyone who woke him up would get burnt by flames from his eyes. Wouldn't that be nice? Nobody would wake you up then, right? So he arranged for that with the demigod. The demigod said, okay, you can do it. So Krishna was fighting with this Kalyavana demon. And he, you know, he's thinking, oh, why should I touch this guy? You know, he's Malecha, Yavana. Eats meat, you know. Of course, Krishna did kill Ravana, who was far worse. He was a man-eater. So, but Krishna didn't want to touch him. So what did Krishna do when the guy attacked him? What did he do? Does anyone know?
I think I know the story from him. Krishna somehow woke up the other one, and he thought that it was Kalyavana, and he burnt him.
Yeah. So what happened was Krishna was running away from Kalyavana, and Krishna ran into a cave where Muchukunda was taking his nap, a long nap. And Krishna just hid, and this Muchukunda was covered with a cloth. So they thought, or at least Kalyavana thought, that Krishna was hiding under this cloth. So what happened is that Kalyavana said, ah, now I've got him. He's scared of me. And Kalyavana, what did he do? He kicked Muchukunda. He said, get up! Fight like a man! So he kept kicking him, and then Muchukunda got up and opened his eyes, and that was it, cremation time. Didn't have to go to the cemetery or anything. He was just like, he was a pile of ashes in a second. So there's an example where Krishna didn't want to fight, and someone else took care of it. And also another example is that Krishna didn't want to fight directly, killed Jarasandha. And who killed Jarasandha? Bhimsen. How did Bhimsen kill him?
Krishna told Bhim the story and told him to murder somehow split him into two pieces again.
Yeah, they fought for like 28 days. Well, the way is Krishna and Bhimsen and Arjuna went and they tricked Jarasandha because they came as Brahmanas and they said, we want the benediction of being able to fight with you. And Jarasandha agreed, but he said, I'm not going to fight with Krishna. He's a coward. Remember that?
Yes.
And Arjuna's too young, you know. But Bhimsen looks pretty good. And so they fought for 28 days and Bhimsen couldn't figure out how to kill Jarasandha. So finally, Krishna went like this, you know, with a branch from a tree and split it. You understand? He took a branch from a tree and went like, he said, you do that. And Bhimsen killed. So there is an instance of a devotee killing a demon. So devotees are perfectly, and Krishna refused to kill Jarasandha. Krishna just ran away from him. Therefore, when Krishna ran away from Jarasandha, he's known as what? What's the name? Ranchorji. Ranchorji. So Krishna is known as a coward. No. That's his opulence of renunciation. You know, six opulences of God. So what I'm showing is that the killing of the demons, establishing religious principles, can be done by Krishna's devotees, even in Krishna's presence. However, Krishna's most important reasons are his internal reasons for coming down. Those are considered the primary reasons. And also another primary reason is to, as we said before, show us what God is like. And not only show us what he's like, but to attract us. Because unless we had Krishna's pastimes to hear about and be attracted to, how would we become renounced from this world? Like Prabhupada said, you have to know God to love God, right? How can you love someone? Keisho, do you love anybody? No. Yourself. So if you don't know someone, how can you love them? So if Krishna didn't come down, how could we love him? And therefore, you find that those who are Vaishnavas or know about the pastimes of the Lord are actually renounced. They can give up things because they have that higher taste of relating to God in love. Whereas others who don't know about the nature of God, even though they may be worshiping God in a secondary fashion, you know, secondary name of God, they don't become detached from this world because they don't have that higher taste, the personal loving exchange, the personal understanding that one can have five different rasas or tastes in relationship to God. That you can become, they may understand you can become the servant of God, but they don't understand, or you can worship God in order and reverence, but they don't understand that you can become the friend, you can become the parent, or you can become the lover of the Supreme Lord. So there's no intimacy in their exchange. They only understand God in terms of his position. They don't understand the person who has the position of God. So only those who hear about the pastimes of God can understand that. Therefore, for us, the most important reason for Krishna's advent is his exhibition of his activities. And for Krishna, the most important reason for his advent is his internal purposes and also his merciful exhibition of his activities. He's doing that out of compassion for us. So everyone understands these points? So here in this verse, There is some guessing by Queen Kunti as to why the unborn, of course unborn means Krishna, Aja is a name from Krishna, why Krishna appears, the why question. I'm just going over what I said before, summarizing it. She's going over the why question, not the how question. Does everyone understand the difference? Why Krishna comes, for his own purposes. And we should understand that, and we should regularly hear about Krishna's activities in this world, because that is a very important reason why Krishna came for us. All right, any questions or comments? Yeah.
Just, it's always the flavor of the month about
flavor of the month.
Atheistic viewpoints. And you mentioned very clearly about the descending and ascending processes.
Yeah.
Just if you could share your realizations from the point of view of the flaws in their epistemology.
Okay. So, you know, Prabhupada talks very briefly about epistemology in the Isopanishad. And he talks, the reason why the ascending process is faulty, he gives four different reasons why the ascending process is faulty in the Isopanishad. What are the four different reasons he gives? Does anyone know?
Imperfect senses.
Mistakes. Illusion. Commitment, so we wouldn't do that. There's one other one. Cheating propensity. So conditioned souls, and, you know, if you're not a conditioned soul, we're not speaking about you. But conditioned souls have these four propensities. Anyone who's conditioned. You understand? We make mistakes. Anyone here? Like Prabhupada gave the example even of, I guess, Mahatma Gandhi, who made mistakes. And as far as imperfect senses, we see things that are not there, or we don't see things that are there. And you can't see beyond this wall, what's on the other side. So they're very imperfect, limited senses. And certainly we have a tendency to cheat others in different ways. And then illusioned. So because of these four frailties or imperfections that we have, whatever we come up with that is not based on Shastra will necessarily be imperfect, misleading, bewildering, and cheating. And you find that most religions in the world today base their understandings upon imperfect speculations by theologians. I mean, even you have, you know, in Hinduism we have the same thing. It's not a criticism of any other religion. Like you have Shankaracharya, whose mission it was to give imperfect speculations about the Vedanta. He wrote his commentary in the Vedanta. Who knows what the name of his commentary is? It starts with an S. Sarirakya Bhasha. And in that commentary, he speculated about the nature of the Absolute and considering the nature of the Absolute impersonal. And also he made some faulty logical statements too about illusion, but we're not going to get into that. And so even in Hinduism you have that. You have so many people who speculate about what God is. Just like I was reading this, what was that magazine I was reading yesterday, Krishna Vijay?
Bodhi Festival.
Bodhi Festival, something like that, about some lady who is the, what was her name? Not her personal name, but she's the Supreme Mother or something like that. I mean, you find people with all these different philosophies. You've got people who come from India who hug people. I'm not going to, don't mention the name. I know the name. And, you know, they hug people, and people line up by the thousands to get a big hug. Maybe it's a good business. Some of you ladies could do that. And, you know, and they throw out, most of the time, I was reading this article yesterday, they threw out so many big words that anybody who reads it will be impressed and bewildered at the same time. You understand? The big words don't even make sense. I'm not going to read it to you, but there's a magazine downstairs you're welcome to read after class about it. So people speculate. Most people, that's a dishonest speculation. And they're not even speculating. They're just like cheating others, you know, throwing out some big words like professors do sometimes at the university so that nobody will understand and people will be impressed. But let's say speculators who are really trying to understand the nature of the absolute truth, they come up with philosophies. Like you take the Christian church, for example. You have what Jesus Christ taught, and most of what Christians believe, it was taught by someone named Paul, who never met Jesus Christ, who even differed from the opinions of Jesus Christ's original apostles, you know, the original followers, So Paul never met. And so 90% of Christian doctrine today is based on Paul. And then in the Christian church, they had this whole discussion of whether Jesus was God or not. So there was literally a physical fight in which different churches were burnt down and people killed. And because the people who won believed that Jesus was God rather than just the Son of God, therefore people today accept that Jesus is God than the Son of God, many of the churches. So you'll find that not only do philosophers speculate, but sometimes they fight physically to establish their own, quote, truth. And so we're not interested in this speculation because these are all imperfect people. We only accept what descends, dharmam tsakshat bhagavat, through disciplic succession. Anyone who's representing his guru, who represents Krishna, all the way back through his guru, through his guru, through his guru, up to Krishna, we accept. But if one person in that disciplic succession breaks it, there's no value. Like there's a saying in English, I don't know if you know the saying, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. That means if you have a chain, big, big, strong iron or steel chain, and there's one plastic link there, it doesn't matter how strong the rest of the chain is. The weakness or the strength is determined by that one weak link, not by the strong links. So if you have one little break in disciplic succession, everything's lost. And Krishna himself talks about that in the Gita. Where does Krishna talk about that in the Gita? Anyone know? How a disciplic succession was broken. The sun god. He said, Imam vivasvate yogam prakdamanaham avyam vivaswan manave praha manurikshvakave pravet. He said, originally I taught the Gita to vivaswan. Vivaswan taught it to who? Who? Manu. Manu taught it to Ikshvakave. And then he said, yoganashta. It was broken. Therefore, he said to Arjuna, I'm teaching it again. So it's important to take our knowledge not only from God, but in an unbroken chain of disciplic succession from God. That's parampara. Vam parampara praptam. This is an important point that's there in the Bhagavad Gita. This is called epistemology. Use that word when you talk to people. Use it. It'll not only impress people, but it's a good word to use. How do you know what you know? Even if you don't want to use that word, you can't remember the pronunciation for some reason. Just ask people, how do you know that you know what you think you believe in? Well, my mother taught me. Well, is that good? Is your mother perfect? She has perfect senses. Don't talk about cheating because they'll get upset. You know, don't say, does your mother have cheating propensity, because they'll get very angry with you. But the other ones, you can talk about it. Isn't it? I mean, wouldn't people get angry if you say your mother's a cheater? But you say, does she have imperfect senses? Did your mother ever make mistakes? No. So, based on that epistemological argument, you can defeat anybody. But use it carefully. Because Prabhupada said, if you go around defeating people, they may become atheists. So it's not that we're interested just in defeating people for the sake of defeating people, but we have the ammunition. You know what ammunition is?
Weapons.
The bullets that you put in your weapons. We have the knowledge, we have the philosophy. And Prabhupada talked, that's the first thing Prabhupada talked about, was epistemology in the Upanishad. First thing. He didn't use that word. But the first thing Prabhupada dealt with was, how do you know what you know? First and most important point is epistemology. So why do we believe? Why do we have faith in what we have faith in? Arjuna also talks about epistemology in the Bhagavad Gita. Where does he talk about epistemology? I was thinking of the 10th chapter. No, the 11th is Virat Rupa. where he says, Param Brahma, Param Dhamma, Paprachama, Paramam Bhavan, Purusham, Sashvato Divyam, Adideva Majam, Vibhuhum. And then he talks about epistemology. He says, Ohustvam Rishiyak Sarve, Devashir Naradastata. Wow. Wow. You are good. So he talks about how all the sages accepted. So that's, if the sages accepted, they're in disciplic succession. So that's why I accept that you're the Supreme Brahman, the Supreme Pure, a Param Dharma, Param. So you're the Supreme Abode. Because it, so epistemology, we should all understand that point very, very clearly. Why do we believe what we believe in? And why do other people believe in what they believe in? Am I being too philosophical for everybody? Because otherwise you won't have faith in what you believe in. Then you'll just like think, well, maybe I should be worshiping the demigods. You know, maybe I should just hedge my bets and put, you know, put Ganesha on my altar. Put, who else are you going to put on your altar? Does anyone worship Indra here? No. I guess it. In the old days we used to worship Indra. So, you know, maybe I should put Durga, maybe I should put Ganesh, maybe I should put Mahatma Gandhi on my altar. Maybe I should put all these people because, you know, in case it's not right. But we have faith because it comes from Krishna. That's why we believe, you know, we could ask devotees, why do you believe what you believe in? And that's, we should be able to answer that question. It comes descending. And so when we, if we ever have an argument or confront people, we can ask people that too, outside of Krishna consciousness. Why do you believe in what you believe in? Tell me why you believe it. Not just what you believe, but why you believe it. Where did you get your knowledge from? I get mine from God. You got yours from your professor or something, from your mother. I mean, we like your mother, but not that much. So any other questions? Yeah.
You mentioned about the primary reasons and the secondary reasons for Krishna's appearance. In practical terms, how do we, in our worship, how do we approach those reasons? Some people say that, oh, we should only concentrate on primary reasons and discuss the Asakata.
No, they're both important. But when we're talking from the Lord's perspective, from Krishna's point of view, the primary reasons are more important from his point of view. But from our point of view, both reasons are equally important. See, when I talk about primary and secondary, that's what Krishna is thinking. Like, why did Lord Ram fight Ravan from his perspective? Why? From Krishna's perspective, the reason is that it was enjoyable. Right? I mean, actually, Lord Ram was having a good time. That's a chivalrous relationship with his devotee. Why did Krishna rush at Grandfather Bhishma with the chariot wheel? And how did Krishna experience the arrows being fired at his body? Like kisses the gopis, practically. You know, don't try that at home. You know, fire an arrow at you, Rupa, and then... Oh, it's like your wife's kisses or something. Okay. But Krishna was enjoying. Really, if you want to analyze the Lord's psychology, it can be analyzed very simply. Why does Krishna do anything? He likes to. He enjoys it. I mean, it's really interesting. You know, why does Krishna play a flute? He likes it. There's no other. Krishna is the cause of all causes. Therefore, his psychology doesn't have any cause, other cause. Just like his body has no other cause, his psychology has no other cause. Our psychology always has a cause. Like, you know, for example, you know, why do you wear a dhoti? Rupa. I mean, I know you like it, but you're fanatic Hare Krishna. But besides that, because you were asked to do so by your guru and by Srila Prabhupada, so. You like, I know you like it. But not that everybody wears a dhoti likes it. Some people would rather be in pants, right? But they do it because of the order of the spiritual master. So there's other reasons. Mm. Like everybody has psychological reasons why they like to do different things. Like why, for example, I don't like to eat beetroots. Why don't I like to eat beetroots? You know, I can go to the psychologist. And when I was young, my mother used to force me to eat beetroots and make soup out of it and just open my mouth and just pour it down. And therefore, I have an antipathy to beetroots now. So that's psychology. But Krishna, whatever he likes because he likes it. There's no other explanation for it. That's God's psychology. So really, when you talk about why does Krishna come down, the ultimate reason is because he likes it. And he likes it for the reasons that he's, let's say Lord Chaitanya, that he's actually able to experience himself from Radharani's perspective, experience the happiness that Radharani experiences, which is greater than his own happiness, and understand her love. Those three reasons. And also, he likes to show himself to us so we'll get attracted. And he likes, as far as appearing, he likes to fight sometimes, too, serious fights. They don't. Krishna has established that there's no serious fights allowed in the spiritual world. There's a rule. When you go to the spiritual world, you see on the notice board. No blood, no serious fights. You can wrestle, but don't go any further than that. So when Krishna wants to have a real, all-out fight, he comes to the material world, and he enjoys that. And he arranges for his devotees to come down so we can have the all-out fight with them. And it's chivalrous. Hiranyaksha, Hiranyakashipu, Ravana, Kumbhakarna. So many nice devotees come down. Would you like to come down and fight with Krishna? Sure. No, it's fun, you know. And also the story of Tulsi Devi, right? You remember that story? With his cursing, and then Krishna kills his devotee, and then has a relationship with him. I mean, so it's just like a really interesting story, because Krishna enjoys political intrigue. Everything that we have in this world is originally there in the spiritual world. We would not have any characteristics unless they were originally there in their pure state, in the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because we are Abhamivamsa Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. We're chips off the old block. We have Krishna's genes. This is like a child. They have the genes of their parents. So we have Krishna's genes in us. I mean, not all of his genes. Not the God gene, but you know, so whatever characteristics we have, you know, we like to fight sometimes. Keshav, you ever like to fight? No. Yeah, you do. We like to be rascals sometimes. We like to be cheeky, right? So Krishna is the ultimate cheeky boy. What does he do? He steals butter and feeds it to monkeys. And he goes around to people's houses when they hide the butter and he pinches their babies. Right? So, I mean, we all have those characteristics of being tricky, cheeky, or whatever you may call it. But it's ultimately, originally there in Krishna. So he wants, you know, it's like we want to fight. You like to watch rugby sometimes? I don't. You do. To me, it just looks like a bunch of gorillas. Yeah, if I want to watch that, I go to the zoo. I don't... At least it's honest at the zoo, right? So like you may like to watch that. So Krishna likes to play a serious game too. Isn't it? I mean, it's nice. That's God. I mean, he's nice. It's just so interesting. He's such an interesting character. And the way God is depicted in other religious traditions, He's not at all interesting. He just sits there on the throne judging everybody. Who wants to worship such a God? The judge. When you have a judge, you just want to bribe him. You don't want to worship him. Right? Isn't that what you think? You picture God as a judge. All you want to do is just like get on his good side so he'll pass some good judgment on you. But if you picture God as an enjoyer, that's a different thing. Then he's really attractive. So we are very fortunate to have God depicted, understood like that. So it's more than Prichanaya, Sadhanam, Vinashaya, Chudishkrutam. That's basically. But all the reasons are important for us. Your question is very good. But for him, the most important are the internal reasons. But for us, equal. Yeah, we don't want to get too rasika, you know, just forget about the Sankirtan movement. Just get into, you know, Gopi Bhava. That's a danger. That's sahajism. So any questions, other questions or comments? Yeah.
So are we just talking about Lord Chaitanya's internal reasons?
Yeah.
What about Lord Krishna's internal reasons?
Lord Krishna's internal reasons are enjoying killing the demons is one thing. Enjoying the killing of the demons and showing us what he's actually like. Like Prabhupada said, in the Krishna book, he said like destroying the imaginative iconography. There's the expression. Showing us and attracting us, because Lord Krishna is, hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu, he's an ocean of mercy. So his reason is to attract us. And also there's many pastimes that Krishna had here in this world that he wouldn't have in the spiritual world. You know, like the killing of the demons, Or kidnapping his people from kidnapping his wives. You understand? Kidnapping his wives, like kidnap Rukmini. Also, there's childhood pastimes, baby pastimes that are not there in the spiritual world too, like Krishna being born. Krishna in the spiritual world is eternally like 16 years of age. But in this world, Krishna has specific pastimes of being born. So there's different relationships that are manifest, or let's say tastes of those relationships that are manifest when you have a little baby than when you have a 16-year-old boy. So Krishna's enjoying the devotees exchanging those different tastes, which wouldn't happen in the spiritual world. Does that make sense? Although in the spiritual world, devotees sometimes act like demons. I'll give you an example. The Brihad Bhagavatamrita talks about this. That there is one devotee who acts like Keshi demon in the spiritual world. But instead of killing him, Krishna tames him and he starts riding him around, gives all his friends horseyback rides around Vrindavan. You read about it? Anybody read the Brihad Bhagavatamrita here? You should read about these things. And then as far as the Kaliya serpent, one of his devotees acts like a Kaliya serpent in the spiritual world. And what Krishna does, not only does he do the dance on top, but he takes the Nagapatni's upper garments and strings them through Kaliya's noses and rides Kaliya around like jet skis around the Jamuna. You know jet skis? He takes it like, shh, and Kaliya becomes tamed. So you actually have devotees who act like the demons in the spiritual world, but they're not actually demons, but there's no killing, but they become tame. Or Ritsasura. Does anyone remember what happened with the Ritsasura in the spiritual world? In the spiritual world, Ritsasura is the bull demon. So Krishna, instead of killing him, he gives him to Lord Shiva. It's interesting, isn't it? This is in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. If you read that, you'll read about this. How the same pastimes that occurred a little bit differently in the material world with the killing occur in the spiritual world without killing in a very nectarian way. And another thing, in the spiritual world, Krishna appears to leave to go to Mathura. He leaves Vrindavan, but then he comes right back. And then they forget about it. And then the next day, Krishna does the same thing. And they forget that Krishna did it the day before. That's nice, because you can... The real nectar is in the taste, the rasa, the taste of the relationship. You understand? The loving taste in the relationship. So in the spiritual world, they're experiencing that all the time. But Krishna also wants to have a more serious fight, so he comes down here. Does that make sense? Krishna has his own reasons. He's God. He can do everything without lifting a finger. Remember that. He annihilates the material world just by breathing in a portion of his plenary portion, right? Who is that? Mahavishnu. If Krishna can annihilate the whole material world just by going, why does he have to come down to kill some little demons? You know, he can annihilate all of us. All, you know, we hope that Mahavishnu doesn't get a cold or else we're all in trouble. Just joking, of course. Because all he has to do is, and that's finished. We're all finished, you know. So Krishna is so powerful like that. All powerful means all powerful. Not like I described that Harvey Cushman. Remember I described that in class, how he wrote a book, God is not all powerful. That's how he explained why bad things happen to good people. He said, you know, it's just not his fault. He's a good guy. He means well, but he just lost it. But we're the ones who most believe in the all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good Supreme Personality of Godhead, in all opulences. I mean, we really have a definition of God. No one else, other than the followers of the Vedic literatures, have a full definition of God. I can say that unequivocally. We have the best definition of God. So any other questions, or is it time to... Yes, Jairam.
Could they make some other reasons for Lord's coming?
You
could throw some light on
that. Well, there are other reasons? What other reasons you're talking about now? Well, he comes to glorify his devotees. That's another reason mentioned here in the verse, yeah.
But he said, I like the reason most is that Krishna comes so that he does his lila and
yeah.
He can remember singing and...
Yeah, that's the most important... For us, that's the most important reason. That's and there are probably reasons we don't even know about. You know, because Krishna has all of his own psychology, his own reasons. But the main thing is he enjoys it, but he wants to attract us so we can go back to him. That's the raso vardham raso pyasa param jasadi vartate, the higher taste. Or like Rupa Goswami says, if you would all desire to enjoy society, friendship, and love, don't do what? Don't go to see what? On the bank of the Keshigat, playing his flute. Because as soon as you hear Krishna's flute, guess what happens? It's all over. You know, you ladies, you leave your husbands. I mean, you know, you drop your babies off like they're, you know, you don't care about them. That's what happens when you hear Krishna. Therefore, the gopis, they continually try to steal Krishna's flute. Because they're, first of all, they're envious of Krishna's flute. Why are they envious of Krishna's flute? Always gets the lips of Krishna's lips. And another reason, Krishna's flute is his instrument for bewildering everybody. So there's this interesting story. One time Radharani grabbed Krishna's flute. And Krishna was upset, of course. But then Radharani's mother-in-law came. What's her name? Starts with a J. Jatila. And she saw that Radharani had Krishna's flute. And she just took it and said, now I got that rascal's flute. He won't be able to call the girls anymore. And so she took it home, and everyone was really upset. And then Vrinda Devi, who was in charge of Vrindavan, and also the animals and everything, she called for her monkey, Kakati, this old monkey. And she said, you go into that house, and you get the flute back. So this monkey... old female monkey. She went into the house, started tearing apart Jatila's house. Everything was thrown on the floor. And Jatila was just like, didn't know what to do. She was just like, let's get rid of the monkey. She was throwing everything she could find at the monkey. And finally she threw the flute at the monkey. and the monkey grabbed the flute and made, you know, teeth out of the monkey. And then ran away with the flute. And Krishna got his flute back. But Krishna has more than one type of flute, too. You know, Vamsi. He has a short flute, bigger flute, medium-sized flute, and a long flute. So Krishna doesn't, you know, even if you steal one of Krishna's flutes, he can come up with another one. But this was a pastime. So, yeah, so that for us, that's perhaps the most important reason, that it attracts us. Therefore, we should read regularly about Krishna's pastimes, about Lord Chaitanya's pastimes, Krishna's pastimes, the incarnation's pastimes, and our mind will be absorbed so much that we will love Krishna. And we will stop wanting to hear about mundane politics. Just like I was in Fiji, looking at, what was that newspaper? The Fiji Sun, for example. There's a whole center section with what?
Bollywood.
Politics is, there's hardly any politics. It's mostly sports in the Fiji Sun. You know, the last section is all sports, but the middle section is all the Bollywood stars and what they're doing, their latest escapades, right? It's definitely not a section for a sannyasi to read. Because one time someone gave me that section, and there are all the ladies there, the men. And it's so boring. You know, who is run off with who? What's so-and-so's latest movie? Who is having an argument with who? I mean, it's pages and pages of that, which is extremely boring. But if you hear about Krishna's pastimes, you will never be interested in Bollywood stuff again. But if you don't hear about Krishna's pastimes, then you're going to look for the same sort of rus in the perverted rus of this material world, right? And that's, you know, either Bollywood or sporting games. Sporting games. I know I may be offending people now. But, you know, this, huh? What joy is there in watching sporting games? Does anyone know? Can anyone tell me? It's called vicarious enjoyment. I'll tell you what the joy is. That means as you're watching, you're feeling as if you were there. If you ever gone to a sports bar or any place like that where a lot of people are watching a sporting activity, they're doing basically the same thing that the people on the field are doing. Get them, get them, get them. Even the ladies are screaming like that. Isn't it? Kill them! And so that's called vicarious enjoyment. You're putting yourself they've done some brain scans of people who are watching sporting games, and they see that they're actually, the brains are firing in the same way as the people on the field. So it's called vicarious enjoyment. So, in other words, if you hear about Krishna, you will lose the desire to do these things. And these things in this world put you more in the bodily consciousness, bodily platform. It doesn't help you. It takes away your taste for Krishna Katha. I mean, I try my best every day to hear a lot of Krishna Katha. Even when I'm bathing my deities, I have an MP3 player that plays the Ramayana. I have the whole Valmiki Ramayana narrated, and I listen to it, and it's very enlivening. I mean, right now I'm hearing the story of Vishwamitra Muni, and it's very enlivening. And I have the whole Brihad Bhagavatamrita, the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita, the whole Chaitanya Bhagavat, the whole nectar of devotion. So I just engage in hearing as much as possible. You know, people ask me, what do I do when I go on an airplane? You know, do I just sit there looking for the plane on the screen to move? Someone was saying that yesterday. They're sitting there, and they just and you just watch. You know, the screen that shows you where you are. Just why isn't it moving faster? You know. No, I take my different equipment. You know, whether it's, you know, iPad or an iPod or whatever, and listen or read, or see some film about Krishna or Prabhupada or something like that. So there's so much time you have available during the day while you're driving, while you're doing your other work, to hear Krishna Katha. And if you hear it, what is that statement in the 10th canto, 1st chapter, 4th verse? Nivritta tarsharu bhagimanas, isn't it? Pavoshara chotra mano biramat. Ka uttama sloga gunanavara puman vira jeta vana pashugnat. Right? You know that verse. That's like an introductory verse to the whole 10th canto. That if you hear about Krishna's activities, then Nivritta Tarsha, all the miseries go away. But the only person who won't be attracted to hearing is Pashubnat, the killer of animals. Pashubnat. Okay. I think we have to end soon, right? Okay, so I want to thank everybody for hearing this rather lengthy class, but it's an opportunity on Sunday to have a little longer class. It's nice to see all the Vaishnavas and Vaishnavis and, yes, all the nice children here. Okay, all glories to His Divine Grace. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Yeah, certainly. No, I haven't found like a comprehensive list of all the internal reasons. But I mean, basically, Krishna comes for his own purposes. There's always internal reasons. I mean, because Krishna can do it without coming. Do you understand that? You understand that point? The point is that all these things can be done. I mean, the example I didn't give in class is that. Is that Hanuman could have killed Ravan because Ravan only had immunity from demigods and higher creatures, right? Not from monkeys. But the reason Hanuman didn't kill Ravan was because he was ordered by Lord Ram just to do specific things, and he wanted to stick to his orders. But he could have killed. But Lord Ram wanted to kill. And Hanuman wanted Lord Ram to be glorified in that way.